A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about skin irritability and eczema in babies. The core question is, in those first couple of years, how do you tell the difference between normal developmental skin stuff and something that actually needs closer monitoring? And then, practically, when is spot treatment from a family doctor enough? And when should parents seek a specialist? And which specialist? Plus, what treatment approaches are actually backed by evidence for this age group? There's a lot to unpack here, because infant skin is this weird frontier where everything looks alarming and most of it isn't.
The thing that makes this genuinely tricky is that infant skin is not just adult skin, but smaller. It's structurally different. The stratum corneum, the outermost layer, is about 30% thinner in infants than in adults. It holds more water but loses it faster. The barrier function is still maturing through at least the first year, and in some kids, well into the second. So you're dealing with a system that is inherently more permeable and more reactive.
Half the battle is figuring out whether you're looking at a transient glitch in a maturing system, or the early expression of atopic dermatitis that's going to stick around.
And atopic dermatitis, which is what most people mean when they say eczema in this context. It's not rare. Prevalence in infants and young children runs somewhere between 10 and 20% depending on the population. The majority of cases present in the first year. So this isn't a niche concern. It's one of the most common reasons parents bring a baby to the doctor outside of infectious stuff.
The word eczema itself, I feel like that's part of the problem. It's used as this catch-all bucket. Parents hear, oh, it's just eczema, and they don't know whether that means slap some cream on it or call an immunologist.
Dermatologists actually hate this. Eczema is a descriptive term. It literally just means a red, itchy, inflamed rash. Atopic dermatitis is the specific chronic condition. But in practice, even clinicians use them interchangeably, and for a parent trying to triage at 2 in the morning, the terminology doesn't help. What helps is having some heuristics around severity, distribution, and treatment response.
Let's build those heuristics. If I'm a parent with a 6-month-old who has some rough patches, maybe on the cheeks, maybe in the creases of the elbows, what's my first filter? When do I just...
The first filter is actually pretty straightforward. If the rash is limited to a few areas, if it's not disrupting sleep, if it's not getting infected, and if it responds to basic moisturizing, that's the mild end of the spectrum, and a family doctor or pediatrician can absolutely manage it. The American Academy of Pediatrics guidelines essentially say that first-line management for mild to moderate atopic dermatitis is aggressive moisturizing plus low-potency topical corticosteroids for flares. You don't need a dermatologist for that.
Aggressive moisturizing sounds like a contradiction in terms. What does that actually mean in practice?
It means you're not dabbing on a little lotion after bath time and calling it a day. The evidence supports what's called the soak-and-seal method. You bathe the baby in lukewarm water, not hot, for about 5 to 10 minutes. Pat dry, don't rub. Then within 3 minutes, while the skin is still damp, you apply a thick emollient. We're talking creams or ointments, not lotions. Lotions have too much water and alcohol content. They evaporate and can actually dry the skin further.
The lotion aisle at the drugstore is basically a museum of false promises.
For eczema-prone skin, what you want is something with a high oil content. Petrolatum-based ointments, plain petrolatum, Aquaphor, that kind of thing, they reduce transepidermal water loss by over 90%. Creams are a bit less occlusive, but more cosmetically acceptable. The key is applying them liberally and frequently. Studies show that with moderate to severe atopic dermatitis, you're looking at something like 200 to 500 grams of moisturizer per week for a small child. That's a lot of goop.
200 to 500 grams a week? That's not moisturizing, that's buttering a turkey.
It's exactly buttering a turkey, and that's the level of commitment that actually moves the needle. And here's the part that a lot of parents miss. You keep doing this even when the skin looks fine. Maintenance moisturizing reduces flare frequency. There was a nice study out of Japan a few years back that showed that twice daily emollient application in newborns at high risk reduced the cumulative incidence of atopic dermatitis by about 30% at 32 weeks.
The moisturizer isn't just treatment, it's prophylaxis.
And that brings us to one of the most important indicators for when you need to escalate. If you're doing aggressive moisturizing, I mean really doing it, consistently, and you're still seeing significant flares, that's a signal. If the baby is scratching to the point of breaking skin, that's a signal. If sleep is consistently disrupted, the baby's sleep, the parent's sleep, that's a signal. Those are the moments when, let's just moisturize more, isn't going to cut it.
What about the distribution of the rash? Because I've heard that eczema in babies tends to show up in specific patterns, and that the pattern itself can tell you something.
In infants, atopic dermatitis typically hits the face first, cheeks, forehead, scalp, and then the extensor surfaces. That's the outside of the elbows and the front of the knees. In older children and adults, it shifts to the flexural areas, inside the elbows, behind the knees. So if you're seeing an infant with flexural involvement early, that's not necessarily a red flag by itself, but it's a pattern worth noting. What's more concerning is widespread involvement. If more than about 20% of the body surface area is affected, you're moving into moderate to severe territory, and that's where specialist referral starts to make sense.
The specialist question, who do you even call?
This is where it gets interesting, and it depends on what else is going on. For straightforward, moderate to severe atopic dermatitis that isn't responding to first-line treatment, a pediatric dermatologist is the right call. They're going to think about prescription topicals, wet wrap therapy, and the newer systemic options. But atopic dermatitis in infants is strongly associated with other atopic conditions, food allergies, allergic rhinitis, asthma. It's part of what's called the atopic march.
The atopic march? That sounds like a parade nobody wants a ticket to.
It's the progression where early eczema seems to pave the way for food allergies, then asthma, then allergic rhinitis. The skin barrier breakdown is thought to be the entry point. Allergens get through the compromised skin, the immune system gets sensitized, and you're off to the races. So, if you've got a baby with significant eczema plus any hint of food reactivity, vomiting, diarrhea, hives, even just refusing certain foods, an allergist should be in the loop. And if there's a strong family history of atopy, that tilts the scales further.
The referral decision tree is basically severity and treatment resistance points you to dermatology, allergic comorbidity points you to allergy, and sometimes you need both in the same room.
Or at least talking to each other, which doesn't always happen. There was a consensus paper in the Journal of the American Academy of Dermatology a few years ago that specifically called out the need for better coordination between derm and allergy in managing pediatric atopic dermatitis. The siloing is a real problem.
Let's talk about the treatment ladder. We've covered moisturizing. What comes next? And what's actually got evidence behind it?
The standard stepwise approach reflected in guidelines from the American Academy of Dermatology and the European Task Force on Atopic Dermatitis goes something like this. Step 1, emollients, trigger avoidance, patient education. Step 2, low to mid potency topical corticosteroids for flares. Step 3, higher potency topicals or topical calcineurin inhibitors. Step 4, phototherapy, systemic immunosuppressants, or the newer biologics.
For babies, the under 2 crowd, how far up that ladder do you typically go?
Most babies will be managed on steps 1 and 2. For topical corticosteroids, the go-to in infants is usually hydrocortisone 2.5% or desonide. Those are low potency. The key principle is to use the lowest potency that controls the flare for the shortest duration needed and never on the face or intertriginous areas for extended periods, because those areas have thinner skin and higher absorption.
The thing every parent is terrified of, topical steroid withdrawal, skin thinning. How real is that at this level?
Topical steroid withdrawal is real, but it's overwhelmingly associated with prolonged use of mid to high potency steroids, not with judicious use of low potency agents for flares. The skin thinning concern, dermal atrophy, is also dose and potency dependent. With appropriate use of low potency steroids in infants, the risk is very low. What's much riskier is undertreated eczema. An untreated or undertreated flare leads to scratching, which leads to skin barrier breakdown, which leads to infection. Most commonly, Staph aureus, and that can land a baby in the hospital.
The fear of steroids becomes its own pathology.
It does, and it has a name, corticophobia. There's literature on this. Parents undertreat because they're worried about the steroids, and the kid ends up with superinfected eczema that requires systemic antibiotics. It's a pattern pediatric dermatologists see constantly.
What about the topical calcineurin inhibitors? Tacrolimus? Pimecrolimus? Those get prescribed as steroid alternatives. Are they used in babies?
Pimecrolimus cream is approved down to age 2 for atopic dermatitis. Tacrolimus, ointment. The 0.03% formulation is also approved down to age 2. Below age 2, it's off-label, but it's used. There was a study in pediatric dermatology looking at pimecrolimus in infants as young as 3 months, and it showed efficacy with a good safety profile. The advantage is no risk of skin atrophy, so they're particularly useful for the face and eyelids where you really don't want to be using steroids long term.
There's that black box warning, right? I remember something about lymphoma risk.
The FDA put a black box warning on topical calcineurin inhibitors back in 2006 based on a theoretical risk from the oral formulations used at much higher doses in transplant patients. The topical formulations have extremely low systemic absorption. Multiple long-term studies and registry data since then have not shown a causal link to lymphoma. The American Academy of Dermatology has repeatedly stated that the warning is not supported by the evidence, but it's still on the label, and it still scares parents.
It's the medicinal equivalent of a scary sign on a fence with no hole behind it.
That's exactly what it is. And the practical consequence is that some parents refuse a treatment that might be the best option for their kid's face eczema, and they end up using steroids there longer than they should, which is actually riskier.
What about the newer stuff, the biologics, the JAK inhibitors? Where do those fit for babies?
This is where the landscape has shifted dramatically in the last few years. Dupilumab, a monoclonal antibody targeting the IL-4 and IL-13 pathways, was initially approved for adults, then adolescents, then down to age 6, and then in 2024, the FDA extended approval down to 6 months of age for moderate to severe atopic dermatitis, not controlled by topicals. That was a big deal.
6 months old? That's a baby who can't even sit up yet, getting a biologic.
The evidence for it is actually quite good. The pivotal trial in the 6 months to 5 years age group showed that dupilumab plus topical corticosteroids significantly improved disease severity compared to placebo plus topical corticosteroids. The safety profile was consistent with what they'd seen in older populations, mainly injection site reactions and conjunctivitis. No new safety signals in the youngest group.
Conjunctivitis as a side effect of an eczema treatment. That feels like the universe having a laugh.
It's an odd one, but it's manageable and typically mild. The more important point is that for the small subset of infants with truly severe refractory atopic dermatitis, the ones who are bleeding through their pajamas, not sleeping, failing topical therapy, dupilumab has changed what's possible. Before this, the next step would have been systemic immunosuppressants like cyclosporine or methotrexate, which have much more significant side effect profiles and require intensive monitoring.
The JAK inhibitors. I know there's topical ruxolitinib, but what about systemic use in this age group?
Topical ruxolitinib cream is approved down to age 12. For the systemic JAJ inhibitors, upadacitinib, abrocitinib, those are approved for adolescents and adults. They're not indicated for young children right now, and given the safety concerns around JAK inhibitors more broadly, infections, blood clots, lab abnormalities, I doubt we'll see trials in the under 2 population anytime soon. The bar for systemic therapy in infants is very high, appropriately so.
Let's circle back to something you mentioned earlier that I want to dig into, the infection piece. You said undertreated eczema can lead to staph infections. How does a parent know when a flare is tipped into something that needs antibiotics?
There are a few clinical signs. If you see honey-colored crusting, that's classic for impetiginized eczema, and it's almost always staph aureus. If the skin is weeping or oozing clear or yellow fluid, that's another sign. If the baby develops a fever along with a worsening rash, that's an urgent care or ER visit, and there's a particular presentation called eczema herpeticum. That's when the herpes simplex virus superinfects the eczema. You see punched-out erosions, small vesicles, the baby looks sick. That's a medical emergency.
Punched out erosions. That's a phrase that stays with you.
It's meant to. Eczema herpeticum can be life-threatening in infants. It requires IV acyclovir. The good news is, it's rare. The bad news is, it's often missed on first presentation because it looks like a bad eczema flare. If a baby with eczema suddenly gets dramatically worse over 24 to 48 hours with vesicles or erosions that look different from their usual rash, that's the red flag.
What about bleach baths? I feel like that's one of those things that sounds like a folk remedy, but actually has some evidence behind it.
Dilute bleach baths, and we're talking half a cup of regular 6% bleach in a full standard bathtub, which gives you roughly the chlorine concentration of a swimming pool, have been studied in randomized controlled trials for moderate to severe atopic dermatitis. The idea is that reducing Staph aureus colonization on the skin reduces inflammation and flare frequency. A systematic review in the Journal of the American Academy of Dermatology found that bleach baths plus moisturizer reduced eczema severity more than moisturizer alone. The effect size wasn't enormous, but it was statistically significant, and the intervention is cheap and safe when done correctly.
When done correctly is doing a lot of work there. I can imagine a sleep-deprived parent at 3 in the morning eyeballing the bleach pour.
Which is why the instructions need to be crystal clear. Half a cup in a full tub, soak for 5 to 10 minutes, rinse off with fresh water, then immediate moisturizer. Not a capful, that looks about right. And never apply undiluted bleach to the skin. This is one of those things where the pediatrician or dermatologist should give written instructions, not just mention it in passing.
Let's talk about triggers and the environmental piece. What actually matters versus what parents obsess over unnecessarily?
The evidence for environmental triggers is mixed and highly individual. Food allergens are the big one that's actually worth investigating, but only in moderate to severe eczema that isn't responding to good skin care. The National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases guidelines recommend considering food allergy testing in infants under 5 with moderate to severe atopic dermatitis, even if they haven't had an obvious allergic reaction, because the prevalence of food allergy in that group is high, around 30 to 40%. The most common culprits are egg, milk, peanut, wheat, and soy.
The testing itself, is this skin prick testing, blood work?
Both can be used, but they need to be interpreted carefully. A positive test doesn't necessarily mean clinical allergy. It means sensitization. You can have a positive egg IgE and tolerate eggs just fine. The gold standard for diagnosis is the oral food challenge, but that's not practical for every child. So this is where a good allergist earns their keep. They can interpret the test results in the context of the clinical history and decide whether an elimination diet is warranted.
Elimination diets in breastfeeding mothers. That's a whole other can of worms.
It is, and the evidence doesn't support routine maternal elimination diets for preventing or treating infant eczema. There was a Cochrane review that looked at this, and the data just isn't there for most cases. If there's a clear, reproducible temporal relationship, the baby flares every time mom eats eggs, and it's happened multiple times, then a targeted elimination might make sense. But blanket avoidance of multiple foods is more likely to cause nutritional problems for the mother than to help the baby's skin.
What about the non-food triggers? Detergents? Fabrics? Pets?
Fragrance is a common irritant, so switching to fragrance, free laundry detergent, and skipping fabric softener is a reasonable, low-cost intervention. Wool and rough synthetic fabrics can mechanically irritate eczema to skin. Cotton clothing is generally better tolerated. As for pets, the evidence is complicated. Early pet exposure might actually be protective against atopic disease in some populations. But if a specific animal clearly triggers the child's symptoms, then avoidance makes sense. The key is not to preemptively get rid of the family dog because the baby has some dry skin.
There's a lot of preemptive guilt in early parenthood. What did I do wrong? Is there anything to that? Do we know what causes atopic dermatitis in the first place?
It's a mix of genetics and environment. The strongest genetic association is with filaggrin mutations. Filaggrin is a protein that's critical for skin barrier function. Loss of function mutations in the filaggrin gene are present in about 25 to 50% of people with atopic dermatitis, depending on the population. But not everyone with the mutation gets eczema, and not everyone with eczema has the mutation, so it's a strong risk factor, not a destiny.
For the parent asking, did I do something wrong? The answer is almost certainly no. You didn't cause this.
And I want to emphasize that because the guilt piece is real and it affects treatment decisions, Parents blame themselves. They go down internet rabbit holes. They try elimination diets and expensive supplements and unproven remedies. And meanwhile, the baby's skin is getting worse and nobody's using the boring, evidence-based, unsexy moisturizer that would actually help.
The boring, evidence-based, unsexy moisturizer. That's the title of my memoir.
It should be a bestseller. But seriously, one of the most important things a family doctor or pediatrician can do is validate the parent's concern, explain that this isn't their fault, and then give them a clear, simple plan. That alone can break the cycle of anxiety-driven overtreatment and undertreatment.
What about probiotics? I've seen claims they can prevent or treat eczema. Is there anything there?
The prevention question has been studied extensively. A meta-analysis in the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology found that prenatal and postnatal probiotic supplementation reduced the risk of atopic dermatitis in infants by about 20%. But the effect was modest. The strains varied across studies, and it's not clear which specific probiotic or dosing regimen is optimal. For treatment of established eczema, the evidence is weaker and more inconsistent.
It's in the might help, probably won't hurt, don't bet the farm on it category.
That's fair. And I'd add, if you're going to try it, use a product that has some evidence behind it for this indication. Lactobacillus rhamnosus GG is one of the better studied strains. But don't spend a fortune on boutique probiotic blends with proprietary names that sound like they were named by a branding agency.
FloraBloom Infant Biome Defense. $60 a bottle.
Meanwhile, the petrolatum that actually works costs $4 at any pharmacy.
Let's talk about wet wrap therapy. I've heard this mentioned as a step between topicals and systemics. What does it actually involve?
Wet wrap therapy is exactly what it sounds like, and it's surprisingly effective for acute severe flares. The protocol is, apply topical corticosteroid or emollient to the affected skin, then cover with a layer of wet cotton bandages or cotton pajamas, then cover that with a dry layer. The wet layer hydrates and enhances steroid penetration. The dry layer prevents evaporation. It's usually done for a few days at a time, often overnight. Studies show it can rapidly reduce severity scores in moderate to severe pediatric atopic dermatitis.
This is something parents can do at home, or is it an inpatient thing?
It can be done at home, but the first time should be demonstrated by a clinician, usually a dermatology nurse or the dermatologist. You need to make sure the parents know the right steroid to use, the right dilution, how to monitor for skin maceration or infection. It's not complicated, but it's also not something you want someone figuring out from a YouTube video at midnight.
You've mentioned Staph aureus a few times. Is there a role for routine decolonization, like mupirocin to the nares, that kind of thing?
The Staph colonization in atopic dermatitis isn't just in the nares. It's all over the eczematous skin. The skin of people with atopic dermatitis is deficient in antimicrobial peptides that normally keep staph in check. So you can decolonize the nares, but the skin will get recolonized quickly. Dilute bleach baths are actually a form of decolonization, and they're safer and more practical for long-term use than topical antibiotics, which carry resistance risk.
What about the role of the microbiome more broadly? There's been a lot of research on the gut-skin axis. Is any of that clinically actionable yet?
It's fascinating science, but not ready for prime time in terms of clinical recommendations. We know that the skin microbiome in atopic dermatitis is different, less diverse, dominated by Staph aureus during flares. There's research into topical microbiome transplants, essentially applying beneficial bacteria to the skin to outcompete Staph. Early phase trials have shown some promise, but this is still experimental. I wouldn't advise parents to seek this out outside of a clinical trial.
The actionable advice for a parent with a baby who has mild eczema, the kind where you're not sure if it's even eczema, is what? Give me the 30-second pediatrician visit summary.
Here it is. If the rash is on the cheeks or extensor surfaces, comes and goes, doesn't disrupt sleep, and gets better when you moisturize, you're in mild territory. Use a thick fragrance-free cream or ointment twice a day, every day, even when the skin looks clear. For flares, use over-the-counter hydrocortisone 1% twice a day for no more than a week. See your pediatrician if it's not improving. That's the baseline.
The red flags that mean stop reading and call the doctor.
The rash is spreading despite treatment. The baby is scratching to the point of bleeding. Sleep is consistently disrupted. You see honey-colored crusting, oozing, or any sign of infection. the baby develops a fever with the rash. Or the rash looks dramatically different from the usual pattern, especially if there are blisters or punched-out erosions. Any of those, call the pediatrician. If the pediatrician isn't sure or the baby isn't improving, that's when you ask for a dermatology referral.
The allergist enters the picture when?
If there's moderate to severe eczema that isn't responding to good topical care, if there's any suspicion of food allergy, or if there's a strong family history of atopy. Also, if the baby has eczema plus failure to thrive or significant gastrointestinal symptoms, that combination should raise the possibility of food protein-induced enterocolitis or eosinophilic esophagitis, both of which need allergy evaluation.
I want to come back to something you mentioned about the atopic march. If a baby has eczema, is there anything parents can do to interrupt that progression, to reduce the chance they go on to develop food allergies or asthma?
This is one of the most active areas of research in pediatric allergy right now. The big finding, and I'm going back to the LEAP study here, Learning Early About Peanut, showed that early introduction of peanut in high-risk infants with eczema dramatically reduced peanut allergy. That study was published in 2015, and it changed guidelines worldwide. The current recommendation is that infants with severe eczema should have peanut introduced as early as 4 to 6 months after appropriate evaluation, which may include allergy testing first.
The paradigm flipped from avoidance to early exposure.
And it's not just peanut. The evidence for early egg introduction is also accumulating. The general principle now is that for high-risk infants, and significant eczema is a major risk factor. Delaying introduction of allergenic foods may actually increase the risk of allergy. This is a huge shift from what pediatricians were recommending 20 years ago.
Does aggressive treatment of the eczema itself reduce the risk of food allergy? The idea being that if you keep the skin barrier intact, allergens don't get in through the skin.
That's the hypothesis, and it's biologically plausible, but the evidence is still emerging. There was a trial in Japan, I mentioned it earlier, showing that early aggressive moisturizing reduced eczema incidence. But whether that translates to reduced food allergy is less clear. There's an ongoing trial called the BEEP study out of the UK that's looking at this question directly. Preliminary results suggested that daily emollient use in the first year didn't significantly reduce food allergy at age 2, but the sub-analyses are still being published.
The skin barrier hypothesis makes sense, but proving it in a trial is harder than it looks.
Biology is messy, and you can't randomize babies to good skin barrier and bad skin barrier in a clean way. But the precautionary principle suggests that keeping the skin barrier intact is a good idea regardless. It reduces flares, reduces infection risk, reduces misery for the baby and the family. If it also reduces food allergy risk, that's a bonus.
What about the role of vitamin D? I've seen some studies suggesting low vitamin D is associated with eczema severity.
There is an association. A analysis in Nutrition Journal found that children with atopic dermatitis had significantly lower serum vitamin D levels compared to controls, and that vitamin D supplementation was associated with improvement in severity scores. The effect size was moderate. The mechanism might be related to vitamin D's role in skin barrier function and antimicrobial peptide production, but it's not a first-line treatment. For a baby with eczema, ensuring adequate vitamin D intake, which is recommended anyway for all infants, is reasonable. Supplementing beyond the standard recommended dose specifically for eczema is not yet supported by strong evidence.
It's another might help, won't hurt, don't bet the farm.
And that's actually a good framework for a lot of the adjunctive stuff. If it's safe, inexpensive, and doesn't distract from the core treatment plan, moisturizing, appropriate topical steroids, trigger management, then fine. The problem is when parents abandon the core plan in favor of an unproven alternative.
There's a broader point here about how we think about chronic conditions in very young children. Eczema isn't life-threatening in the way that, say, a congenital heart defect is, but it can be life-altering. The sleep disruption alone, for the baby and the parents, that has cascading effects on development, on family functioning, on mental health.
This is something that's underappreciated. There was a study in the British Journal of Dermatology that looked at quality of life in families with a child with atopic dermatitis. the impact was comparable to having a child with other chronic conditions like asthma or diabetes. Parents reported sleep loss, anxiety, social isolation, financial strain from treatments, and the worse the eczema, the greater the impact. So when we talk about just moisturize more, we need to acknowledge that for some families, this is a significant burden.
That burden is invisible to people who haven't lived it. You tell someone your baby has eczema, they picture a little dry skin. They don't picture a child who scratched their face bloody in the crib.
Or parents who haven't slept more than 3 hours straight in months. Or the dozens of creams and ointments piled on the bathroom counter, each one tried and abandoned. Or the well-meaning relative suggesting coconut oil and gluten-free diets. It wears people down.
Which is why having a clear, evidence-based plan and knowing when to escalate is not just about the skin. It's about preserving some semblance of sanity.
That's the thing I'd want every parent listening to take away. You don't have to figure this out alone. There's a well-established treatment ladder. Most babies with eczema will do great with basic skin care and occasional low-potency steroids managed by their pediatrician. For the ones who need more, there are effective options. Topical calcineurin inhibitors, wet wrap therapy, and for the very severe cases, dupilumab is now available down to 6 months. The tools exist. The challenge is navigating the system to get to the right tool for the right child at the right time.
The system is not always easy to navigate. Wait times for pediatric dermatology can be months. Allergy appointments can be hard to get. What does a parent do in the gap?
That's the practical reality, and it's frustrating. In the gap, the pediatrician or family doctor needs to be empowered to manage more aggressively than they sometimes are. That means being comfortable prescribing mid-potency topical steroids for short courses, being comfortable with wet wrap therapy, being comfortable ordering and interpreting basic allergy testing. And for parents, document everything. Take photos of the rash at its worst. Keep a symptom diary. Track what you've tried and for how long. When you finally get to the specialist, that documentation is gold. It can compress months of trial and error into a single appointment.
The photo diary is such a simple thing, but I bet most parents don't think to do it because they're in survival mode.
They're absolutely in survival mode, and that's exactly why pediatricians should be telling them to do this at the first visit. Bring them to your follow-up. It takes 30 seconds, and it changes the quality of the consultation dramatically.
All right, let's bring this home. The prompt asked about indications for when spot treatment from a family doctor is enough versus when to seek a consultation, and with whom, and what treatment approaches are backed by evidence. I think we've covered both, but let me try to synthesize.
Go for it.
Spot treatment from a family doctor or pediatrician is appropriate for mild to moderate eczema, limited body surface area, no sleep disruption, no signs of infection, response to moisturizers, and low-potency topical steroids. The evidence-backed treatment at this level is aggressive moisturizing with thick emollients, soak and seal, plus short courses of low-potency, topical corticosteroids for flares. You escalate to dermatology when the eczema is severe, widespread, not responding to first-line treatment, or complicated by recurrent infections. You bring in allergy when there's suspicion of food allergy, a strong atopic family history, or the eczema is part of a broader atopic picture. For severe refractory cases, dupilumab is now approved down to 6 months. And throughout all of this, the boring stuff, moisturizing, trigger avoidance, not scratching, remains the foundation.
That's a solid summary. The only thing I'd add is that the threshold for referral should be lower when there's diagnostic uncertainty. If the pediatrician isn't sure whether this is atopic dermatitis versus seborrheic dermatitis versus something else, and infant rashes can look very similar, getting a dermatologist's eyes on it sooner rather than later prevents the wrong treatment from being applied for months.
The wrong treatment in one direction is undertreatment, and in the other direction it's overtreatment, and both have consequences.
Both have consequences, and the kid in the middle just keeps itching.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1920s, the Hanseatic League had been officially defunct for over 250 years, but a group of German merchants attempted to revive its trade privileges by petitioning the French colonial administration in Djibouti for a special Hanseatic warehouse district. The French governor reportedly considered the proposal for 3 weeks before realizing the petitioners had no legal standing whatsoever and were essentially a historical reenactment society with business cards.
That feels like the physical manifestation of fake it till you make it.
A historical reenactment society with trade ambitions. I respect the audacity.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for keeping the wheels on. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps other people find the show. We'll be back with a new prompt next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.